Okay, Tom Hanratty is Communication Manager with My Mind. Good morning, Tom.
Greg, how are you?
Good, great to see you. Thanks for joining us. Okay, talk to us about My Mind. What does this organisation do?
So we're a social enterprise offering psychotherapy, counselling and psychological support sessions around the country. It's basically a blended model of online and face-to-face services that we offer, albeit we have five urban centres only in Dublin, Cork and Limerick. So outside of that, our services are offered predominantly online. We have a network of over 220 mental health professionals working around the country, offering these services through either phone or online, or if they're working outside of the face-to-face centres.
Yeah, and your service is being extended now to cover those affected by the defective concrete crisis scandal.
Yes, exactly. So the Department of Housing have approached us and they've provided a certain amount of funding for us to provide these our services, albeit that they will cover the cost of it. So the services are free of charge for anyone who has been impacted in by defective concrete blocks in the counties of Donegal, Mayo, Clare and Limerick.
And to help them through how it's impacting their mental health, or like, in other words, what element of that experience of theirs would they benefit from in terms of these sessions that they'll have available to them?
Yeah, exactly that. It basically supporting what's obviously a very difficult situation from a mental health perspective. So trying to help them, the people impacted, and help them through the situation and improving their mental health through that.
Okay, so through this, six sessions are being offered of counselling on a first-come, first-served basis. How many spaces do you have available?
So we don't have necessarily a cap on it, albeit, you know, we...
Is it a cap on resources? Is it once the resources are exhausted, then the sessions end? Is that it?
Yeah, exactly that. So we do have a limited number of sessions that we can deliver, but at that point in time, the services will still be open and they'll still be available, but we might not necessarily have the funding to cover them free of charge.
And how much was My Mind given to provide the support for people affected by mica, defective concrete?
I don't actually have that figure in front of me, Greg, I'm afraid, no.
Right, okay. Now, is it in person, is it remotely, or is it whatever best suits the person making contact?
So, as I mentioned, our face-to-face centres are in Dublin, Cork and Limerick. So, obviously, we don't have any physical presence in the affected counties, unfortunately. And so, I suppose, as a side project to this, or as separately to this, but at the same time, we've actually been looking into how we can deliver face-to-face services across the country, because we're seeing a growing demand even since we've come out of COVID. And maybe it's, I suppose, people being maybe just too used to such online interactions that there's a growing demand for face-to-face services. So we're looking into how we can provide that across the country, albeit that the current model that we have of, you know, sizable urban centres where we have multiple rooms, multiple therapists working out of, and we rent a building as a whole, that's not necessarily what we're looking for at the moment, just given the cost incurred, etc. But we're looking at potentially developing partnerships with GP practices or other primary care facilities that are already established, already operating in local communities, to see if we can partner with them, rent rooms or space available, and offer face-to-face services that way.
Yeah, and there are going to be counselling services available to the people of Donegal. It's one of the counties involved in this extension, obviously. So
absolutely, yeah.
When do you hope to be able to deliver these face-to-face services? I mean, remote is fine, but for some people they don't really engage well in that sort of environment. I seen some coverage of this where it was like an appeal for a facility. So in other words, if someone out there has a space, are you open to them offering that space and saying, look,
absolutely,
this is important.
Yeah,
that's
essentially what we're looking for. So, I mean, I suppose the one part is that the services are currently available and they're active. So if anyone is looking to avail of the services, they can contact our office on 0818 500 800 or HQ@mymind.org, and somebody would essentially apply the code, which means they can get the free of charge services. But as you pointed out, at the moment, they are only currently available online, given that we don't have a physical presence. So the other part to it is that, yeah, we would love for anybody working or representing a facility within Donegal specifically, or any of the other affected counties, if they feel there's a suitable premises or facility there that has space available, and that there might even be interested in discussing this or looking at it further, we'd love to hear from them as well. So any potential opportunities for partnership there, we'd be delighted to hear from anybody.
All right, listen, thanks for your time this morning, Tom. I do appreciate it. And people can go to that website. What is it once again?
So mymind.org, you can find all the details through our website there.
All right, thanks very much indeed. Tom Hanratty, Communications Manager with My Mind. On the face of it, sounds great. I would be interested to find out how much money has actually been allocated for that, and how much counselling can be provided through it. But anyway, great talk today regarding Sinead O'Connor. People weren't too kind to her when she called a spade, is this an Irish thing? Well, some of it was ahead of her time. You have to remember, when she spoke out about certain issues, the country probably wasn't really ready for it. She formed part of opening that conversation. The same you could say of Gay Byrne as well, people like that. But obviously, you know, she had a very difficult time of it as well. Is Noreen O'Sullivan, the previous Garda commissioner who could not account for 12 mobile phones used by them, was Drew Harris's appointment a political stunt? Who knows, asks a question. Another, can a police force operate if it's at loggerheads with its commissioner? I don't think so. Mr. Harris may not be the best choice for the job. Personally, I can't see how you can have the rank and file, have a vote of no confidence in you, and still stay in that position. I really don't see how that's doable. But we'll see. They're hoping that it puts pressure on him. All right, Dear Greg, with Keely's coming up shortly. If you have a question that you want answered as it relates to a relationship with someone in your life, maybe it's your other half, or potentially another half, or maybe it's a family member. I always say that sometimes, you know, when we have our issues, we don't want to talk to those closest to us, because we don't want them then to sort of have their views changed as the person we're seeking advice about. So this is a safe space for you to WhatsApp or text in confidence to 086 60 25000, and if we can get a question answered for you from our expert Keely Taverner, then we shall do so. So stay right where you are. That is coming up just after these messages. It's time for us to say a very good morning now to Keely Taverner, psychotherapist, author and coach. Good morning, Keely. How are you getting on?
I'm doing well. I'm not too bad. How are you, sir?
You're looking vibrant.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm on a bit of keto at the moment, eating avocado every day.
Do you mash it, or just what way do you have it?
Nah, I just, as it comes. Okay. As it comes.
Right, good stuff. As I said, Keely Taverner is a psychotherapist, author and coach. Any questions, getting them into us now, 086 60 25000, or call on 074 91 25000. Do you know, I might just get straight into it, Keely, because lots of people have been messaging in and we carry some over as well. But this is what I wanted to go for here, because I think this is kind of typical of what happens out there. My partner's job is causing them a lot of stress, and it's starting to affect our relationship now, Keely. How can I support them and help them find a healthy work-life balance?
Well, firstly, do they want your help? Always the best question to ask the self, because unsolicited, undesired, unwelcomed help will create more stress for you. Is this a problem for them? Is the question.
Mm.
Because otherwise you're trying to resolve a problem and the person does not perceive that they have a problem. So that would be my first inquiry, would be to be curious about, does your partner perceive that they have a problem? And if they do, I would encourage you to think about encourage them to see what they think they should do about it.
With things like, life is tough, Keely. That's the truth. You know, it comes at you really, really quick. I mean, also maybe they need to talk about how they deal with stress. Do you know what I mean? Like how they're dealing with stress. So it's not necessarily work-life balance, but how do you deal with the stress of your work? Because it's stressful for all of us. Like you hear a lot of stuff You can't carry that with you. I'm sure some of it you do, but you have to find a way that when you finished a session, or when it's Keely time, or whom, you know, or your family time, whatever it is, you've had to learn, I'm sure, and use some of your own techniques to sort of say, right, I have to park that now. Your job is stressful for a different person.
Absolutely. I got to the point where, you know, your health begins to fail. You end up putting on weight. In my early days, I started to get cold sores, right?
Yeah.
These are all physical bodily signs that all is not well.
Mouth ulcers.
Oh, is that yours?
Yeah.
I don't have those ones yet.
Mm.
Yeah, but I know if I get that tingle, I have to start to address work-life balance, which is tricky if you really love what you do as well, because sometimes it just doesn't feel like work. But I guess the challenge in this particular situation is if someone is quite comfortable to work in that way, you have to be careful if it then becomes your problem and not theirs. And then maybe as a partner, you might want to do things. So one of the biggest issues I'm seeing much more in the therapy room, this legacy of COVID, is social anxiety based on working from home. People who've been working home for a long time now have become a little bit spoiled to some degree, where now they're anxious about taking the train, anxious about getting out there. And with, you know, and when they present in therapy, I just get curious about lifestyle. What I've observed is they're working longer hours, they're actually giving more and actually not getting dressed properly, you know. And this has a kind of compounding effect. So some of the things might be, as a partner, you might say, well, let's put something in the diary. So I don't know, at least on a Thursday at 6, we go salsa. I say to many of my clients, you've got nothing else in your diary. What happened to the things you enjoy? A lovely client I'm working with came stressed out and he's just reinvigorated his swimming. Something, it just went very good at school. And over the years, you know, with the aspiration to aspire up, to get more money, get the bigger house, stop renting, what happened is the self-care, which isn't just about, you know, getting your hair and your nails done. Self-care is going for a swim after work. All of those small things just began to, they just dropped away.
I'm thinking, Keely, how many people are listening who are perfectly happy, but that resonates with them for different reasons. It could be having a baby or something whereby you've got yourself into a rut whereby you don't feel happy. But then if you were to look at your diary, you're not doing an awful lot of stuff that you used to do before. You know, that I think that's actually really quite an interesting thing to look at in your own life, regardless of whether you're single or in a happy relationship or otherwise.
Absolutely.
Really.
Absolutely.
And why are we giving up certain things? Because, do you know what I mean? Like I'm thinking here now, I don't do things that I used to, but why not? I possibly could. Probably maybe have the odd game of golf.
There you go.
I've kind of sort of accepted that that's a sacrifice of being the father of a young child, but there's no really reason why I shouldn't.
Exactly. And that's important, but that also can suggest to your client, your partner, what might she need to think about?
Oh, she has the life of Riley. It's all me.
You're married well. Well done, sister. You're married well. Married well. If he's playing golf, she's picked a winner.
Okay. No, but I think it's best to be honest. You know, like, there's no point me sitting. I'm just a regular person. I get it too. Right. My partner and I have been talking about getting married, but we're not sure if we're ready. How can we know if we're ready to take this big step in our relationship?
Well, there are some courses. I know the courses I always recommend for people is the marriage course, which is done by a church, and that is in London. I think it's part of the Alpha course. I think that can also help people to get prepped.
Yeah, I think pre-marriage courses in certain religions are more common here. So, yeah, that is a thing here too, obviously, Keely.
Yeah, I would really, I recommend that. And you don't always have to be a believer either. But actually the structure, so looking at things like finance, your values, because values are, I believe, one of the most important concepts in relationships, because if you've got values clashes, you can predict that their problems, you know, will come. So I'm a massive fan of encouraging people, if they're not too sure, check out the marriage course. I think there's also a book, I'm looking for it now, I'll probably never find it, that I've also recommended. I think it's by Nikki Gumbel about marriage preparation. And I think that's a wonderful place a wonderful place to start. Mm. And if you can get a physical course, that's even better, where you actually get up and go, because you're likely to meet other couples. And it just can help to really ground you to get much more clearer about the way forward. And obviously with the narcissism specialism that I deal with, having conversations about finance, what we may do, should we part, you know, the more I understand this, I'm working with solicitors at the moment. I think these are really important conversations. Yeah.
And I suppose our expectations of the other, once it's formalized in inverted commas, if you know what I mean, that you know, like, well, what, you know, all of a sudden you could find on day one the fellow or the woman saying, well, or, and if it's a same-sex partnership, where whatever applies, going, well, now we're married, such and such. Oh, well, we never had that conversation before.
Absolutely. And finances is one of the, well, it's one of the major factors for divorce and separation in relationships. And so these courses actually really take people through the steps for the things that often happen that can cause relationship breakdown. For example, love languages, that's important to understand if you're someone who prefers, you know, acts of kindness, or you prefer gifts. Like, beginning to understand how each other operates can be really important. I think it's a really sensible move, because at the far end, you know, when relationships don't necessarily work out, that these things have been put in place in the first case, and you've had those conversations before.
What about the old saying, if you're prepared to fail, you fail to prepare?
Well, there you go. And I mean, I've heard some people of late saying a marriage is like a business agreement. And I kind of pushed back against that. But now, the more I'm working with people going through, you know, disagreement, separation, there's a kind of uncomfortable element about that. And I think in these courses, you do look at things like finance, what you've brought into the marriage.
But you know what, too? You've expressed your concerns, obviously, and I know particularly in terms of narcissism, it's something that you're very focused on, but also coercive control. I suppose if those boundaries and those rules, not rules, those situations are set out, it kind of maybe, you know, firstly gets the conversation out in front before you perhaps commit. But secondly, too, it removes maybe some of those conversations or pressures or coercions that can happen in a relationship, because everyone knows that everyone's got their independence or their exit strategy. That again sounds terrible. But I would say, rather, I kind of went at it with a negative, but maybe it goes in there and it actually takes that problem out of the relationship so you can focus on other stuff.
Absolutely, because you've had those difficult conversations before, in that, so you've got clarity moving in, you know. So for example, if you're going to inherit your parents' house, or you've inherited it, you know that some, as I understand, prenups are honoured in the UK. The solicitor I spoke to last week was talking about, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like what I bring in before remains mine. What we create together. Is, and that's how it works. And I think because I see people at the far end who, especially if a partner's the breadwinner, it really becomes very sticky. And I know we want to believe in love, and I think that is a wonderful, beautiful thing. I really truly do. And I do believe there is space to talk about, okay, what if, what do we need to put in place so that you're both clear?
I think included in that is a value. An actual value of the breadwinner's income that their partner, you know, they facilitate them being the breadwinner. Do you know what I mean? There's a huge value to that. How that's accrued over years, I don't know. Okay. My partner has a hard time expressing their feelings, and it's causing problems in our relationship. So how can I get them to open up more to me?
Run that past me again.
My partner has a hard time expressing his feelings, and it's causing problems in our relationship. How can I get him to open up more to me?
It's challenging, you know. So they say, you know, men are from Venus, women are from Mars, one of those ones. I think, you know, some people are very logically based, and it's not their natural way to be emotionally expressionate, especially if they're very logical, right? Big up to all the accountants and IT consultants who often come into therapy kind of wanting to work out what's going on. I think that can be very frustrating. There's no two ways about that. And, you know, some of the things that I often recommend sometimes is you can buy like cards relationship cards. I used these in the partner before, actually. I'm not here to promote them, but
that's fine. It's fine. Yeah.
It's really a wonderful way to start a conversation.
Do you have it over a glass of wine or something, or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's. I've also bought cards from the School of Life on relationship. And I remember once asking a partner, I said, who do you think puts, the question was, who puts more into the relationship?
Oh, no.
Me or you? It was an eye-opening conversation.
Did you get to the second card, or did it just at the end night end on that one?
No, because I thought, you know it's me that puts all the energy in. I was left reeling a bit, but I got to the truth. So, it's a profound way to begin to...
It's a simple question, but, you know, who's to say what annoyance someone harbours because they believe it's they, or, you know, so that's really interesting and see the benefit of that.
Yes, it brings up what might not usually be articulated. I really encourage people to get relationship questions. It's and you know what? It's good on car journeys.
Yeah. You've said that before. You've said that before. I'm not convinced, but anyway, you are the expert. Keely, do you see any trend or pattern in emotional maturity? You know, I presume you see people of all ages, and we have the conversation on this program from time to time about how young people are being reared now, how they're being maybe protected from certain things or exposed to other things. Maybe we're overprotective, or maybe they're living at home for longer than they used to. Are you only seeing any noticeable pattern in sort of emotional development? It's like that question a little earlier on about the two of them. The two of them can't decide whether to get married or not. And it's a good question and a good question to pose, but I just wonder, is there anything to that? I'm not attributing it to that comment, but I do wonder sometimes.
What I notice in private practice is people are using their insurance packages. So if you get Bupa, Aviva, AXA, and you get access to therapy, I think what I'm seeing now is more people using that service that would have never... potentially through from COVID and when there might be an annual health check, expressing, for example, I drink a little bit too much, and then being referred on. So I think there's something quite interesting about what I see that through, more so through EAP, it's called Employee Assistance Programs. And I'm getting a lot of men coming through, and working with men is very different in terms of talking about emotions. There's just different tactics, because it can create, you know, a resistance, a reaction. So I'm mindful of that. And I think should people are becoming much more aware of mental health. And I think generally the challenge is, if you don't have insurance, you may not be able to access it in the way that you would like. But I think more and more people are using, if they have those benefits with an employer, that service to begin to make more sense of themselves and their world. And I see a lot of men using that in ways I don't think they would have before.
Right, two questions, if you don't mind. My friend is just a bit too friendly with guys when we go out. I love her partner and we are all really good friends. He's a really nice guy. Nothing has happened, but I know if he's seen her in action, he'd be absolutely gutted. I don't know if I should say something or not.
I guess I always go inwards. So I'd be curious about, what is your distress about? What is it about her behaviour that distresses you? And like you said, potentially that's because you know that if her partner was there, she would rein it in. It may be worth a conversation. It may be just worth a conversation. Own it for yourself. Own it like, you know, I just wanted to have a conversation with you. I've noticed that when we were out on a night, XYZ, because I find it a bit uncomfortable, you have to own it and not judge. Judgment is just going to take it far left, especially if you think you're coming from a moral high ground. I would say it about addressing it in a curious way, owning how you feel uncomfortable about it, and then seeing where that goes. Like, and letting your friend know it comes from a place of love.
Is there any scenario where, though, she goes to the partner and says, look, at when we're out, your other half, puts it about a bit socially?
Well, you just wrecked your relationship with your friend, right?
Yeah. And the other half, he could go on the defensive, say, hey, I trust her. Why are you getting involved in our stuff? You know, you could find yourself down two friends.
Let's be frank. My lawyer is to my friend.
Mm.
You know, so I'm going to have the conversation there first before I go off to any partner. I'm going to want to have a dialogue with my friend first. Yeah. I wouldn't be of the what they say, snitches get stitches. Yes. Forgive my colloquialism, but I think I would start with my friend.
Yeah.
That's the best of our relationship.
Yeah, my partner insists on sharing everything on social media. Last week, she tagged me in a silly photo that I never wanted to see the light of day. I do have an online reputation through work, and I've made it very clear that I don't want this stuff shared, so what should I do?
Have the conversation.
Unfriend her. Block her. Or block him.
Exactly. Especially if you've got a public persona and it's not in keeping with, you know, if you're out on
the... Well, everyone has now. If you're in the guards, if you're a teacher or the police force, a teacher, you know, I mean, work for the NHS or the HSE, you know, everyone now has got a public profile, don't they?
Absolutely. I think for some people, they can be much more free. Like, for example, I have to be mindful about what I post, and I don't tend to post my personal life because of the nature of what I do. So obviously it depends on the nature of what they do, but I think it's important to express that this is not for me. But people can take that really personally, because they may be someone who spends a lot of time on social media and may need to, display how wonderful their life is. And sometimes this can be about having different values.
I think people, genuinely don't judge people. Everyone's different. Everyone's situation's different. I get that. But you do wonder sometimes when it's clear that people live their life on social media, that they believe social media is actually real when we all know it's not. You do wonder what's missing in the real life, if that makes sense.
I mean,
social media is important, don't get me wrong, but it ain't all that either.
No, exactly. And for some people, they're trying to portray a particular lifestyle, and that's their fine. But if you and your partner are on different pages, that's definitely something to have a conversation about.
All right, Keely Taverna, hiya to your Instagrammers, psychotherapist, author, and coach. If people want to get in touch with you, Keely, how do they go about doing so?
keyforchange.com.
Simple as. Have a lovely one. Take care of yourself. Great to see you looking so happy. All right, Keely Taverna there. 086 60 25,000. WhatsApps and texts to that number. Or give us a call on 07491 25,000. It is 11:31 on Thursday. Friday tomorrow, of course, we have our Friday panel lined up for you. A great combination of guests to discuss the big stories of the day and week between 9 and 10. Anything you want them, we can see if we can throw it on the agenda. Message us, 086 60 25,000. What might you be interested to hear about? Maybe if I started getting the lineup on a Thursday. We do have it all well planned out and all, so what an advance. And what else do we have? Is Seamus on tomorrow? No, it's not. That's next week, isn't it? But we definitely have Michael and Fionnuala in 11 till 12 as well. That and so much more besides. Right, okay, that's tomorrow though. We still got 28 minutes to get through today. Okay, the latest round of stats from the census have been released by the CSO. Brendan Murphy, statistic, number cruncher, joins us on the programme now. Hi, Brendan.
Hi, Greg. How's it going?
Good to chat to you. The latest release focuses on housing figures in Donegal, just out this morning. So what are the headline figures from the census in this regard, Brendan?
So we can see now that there were... nearly 86,000 houses and apartments in Donegal in the 2022 census. That's up from 84,000 in just under 84,000 in 2016. So that's an increase of 2% in the housing stock. So we've seen is the housing stock has increased by say less than the population, which is up by a bit more than that. But while some people are obviously moving into these additional houses or new homes, a lot of people are moving into vacant dwellings. So we've seen a fall in the number of vacant dwellings in Donegal. It's down 11%. So we've now about 12,500 vacant, down from 12,500 vacant homes down to 11,000 vacant homes.
Now, what will happen, and it always happens, is people will start conflating vacant homes and holiday homes. So just break that down for us so it's absolutely clear as to the makeup there, Brendan.
So yeah, so the number of the number, so 12,000 vacant homes down from 12,000 vacant homes to 9,500, but the number of holiday homes is actually up from 11,000 to 12,500. So that's a separate thing. Yes, yeah, so there's been an increase in holiday homes. They're unoccupied on census night. So holiday homes are where, you know, a house that's used for occasional use, maybe by the owner or by the, or, you know, but for as a short term let or short term rental property. But then a vacant dwelling is a dwelling where no one lives normally, and there's no one there on census night, and somewhere where no one would call home. And now, it does include maybe some properties that might be vacant for a short period of time, maybe a property that's being sold, the owners have moved out, it's on the market before the next owners move in, and then it wouldn't include other, you know, properties like that. But then it does include then, you know, longer term vacant properties that might be vacant for a number of years. And, you know, we can see that we can actually look at kind of, you know, at how long, you know, properties are vacant. And we've looked at, you know, whether properties are vacant over in the 2016 census and were still vacant in the 2022 census. And we can see that about 6%, I think, of properties in Donegal were vacant in both censuses. So that's kind of a smaller amount that are maybe vacant over the longer period.
That's 6%, isn't it? You said 6%. So really, yeah. The figures indicate that the increased demand for housing is being met by people moving into vacant dwellings rather than new housing stock. I mean, that's what the figures indicate.
Yeah, in places like in areas like Donegal, that's what's happening, and in Leitrim similarly, but then in other parts of the country, in Meath and Kildare, you know, there's kind of the number of new homes is increasing at the same rate as the populations of this kind of people. Kind of homes being built in Meath and Kildare, and then people are moving into those homes. Whereas in other areas where the population is increasing, the housing stock's not increasing at the same rate, but people are moving into vacant dwellings. Yeah, and the number of vacant dwellings is coming down. So yeah, there's, I think, 11% of homes were vacant in Donegal, down from like 14% in the previous census.
Over the course of the last 6 years, there's only been an increase of less than 1,000 in owner-occupied homes in Donegal. Now, when you consider the amount of people that would be either moving to the county or coming to the age of maturity whereby they might be looking to own a home, how does that figure compare nationally off the top of your head? It seems tiny. Over 6 years, less than 1,000 extra owner-occupied homes in Donegal?
Yeah, well, I suppose what you've got is you've got fewer people who have a mortgage now, so that's down about 10%. So the number, there was about 16,000 people with a mortgage in Donegal who owned their home with a mortgage in Donegal in 2016, but that's down to less than 15,000. So there's kind of fewer people taking out mortgages, and as we said in Donegal, there's not as many new builds, so there's not as many people moving into these new build properties. But the number of people who own their homes outright has gone up, so there's more people who've paid off their mortgages. So that's like maybe about less than 26,000 in 2016. That's up to over 28,000 now. So there's kind of 3,000 more people have kind of bought their homes and don't have a mortgage anymore. But there are more people renting. So the number of renting is up 13%. So we've 8,400 people nearly, or 400 households renting in Donegal in the last census. So that's gone up a bit.
And we're seeing an increase too in a huge jump, albeit from a relatively low base, of older people, 65 and over, who are living in rented homes.
Yeah, so I suppose the whole population is getting older, and as the population is getting older, then people who are renting, say in their 50s, and then in this census now, they're in their 50s in the last census, and now they're in their 60s in this census, and so they're still renting, and so we're seeing increases in the numbers that are renting, but it's people that were, say, renting in the last census are kind of still renting in this census, but they're getting older. So as opposed to maybe people who are it's not so much people that who would have owned a home and are now renting, it's more that people who were renting in the last census are still renting, but they've gotten a bit older. So yeah, we have seen that. It's about 17,000 households now over the age of 65 renting. And I think it's 632 in Donegal, which that's 70% more households where the kind of the main person living there was over 65 and over.
Now, this is one that flabbergasts me, because there's been new questions asked in the most recent census. One of the questions was, how many do you have a working smoke alarm in your home? In Donegal, am I reading this correctly? And I wonder, are these occupied homes? 2,150 homes in Donegal, they don't have a smoke alarm.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, so that, and they would be occupied homes.
Wow.
And yeah, I think we saw 72,000 homes across the country where the people living there said that they'd no working smoke alarm. That figure for Donegal, there, yeah, that's where somebody's living. You can see it. It's obviously mostly the age of the home isn't the main factor. Maybe slightly more common in older homes. Some of the newer homes now often have you know, multiple smoke alarms, like three or four. You can see that in the data that people are responding. There's more smoke alarms in newer homes, but there's still a kind of a consistent amount of homes that don't have a smoke alarm. And I think it's slightly higher in detached homes rather than like maybe semi-detached houses or apartments. So some of the maybe older detached houses are less likely to have a working smoke alarm.
Well, get it. We need to get everyone needs a smoke alarm.
Yeah. The question was a working smoke alarm. Maybe they just need to put the batteries in or whatever.
I know.
But it's important, yeah, that people...
And a lot of people have an out-of-date smoke alarm thinking it's a working one as well. But listen, we're not going to get into that, Brendan. Just last one, actually, by the way. And again, albeit from a lower base, but that's in the context of wages and disposable income being from a lower base as well. But rent went up just short of 30% over the course of the last 6 years in Donegal.
Yeah, so the average weekly rent in Donegal is 134 euro per week, or was 134 euro per week in the last census. So, it's been going up. It went up in the previous census as well, and it's gone up even more again. So that works out, I think, about 575 euro per month.
I'm shocked at that's the average rent in this county. I think if there were 100 houses now with rent of 550 a month, their hands would be bitten off them. Does that include, which might skew the figures a little bit, social housing stock?
That would be rent. I think that's the rent to the, I have to just double check, I think that's the rent to the private landlord.
Right, okay.
Separate one for the social housing stock. I think what you can find is that the average rent, on advertised rental properties can be a bit higher. So people who are looking to move into a property for the first time, their rent can be a bit higher than people who have been in a property for a longer period of time, and maybe the rents haven't increased. But
good
the
point.
Same rate.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay.
That's something we've seen. All right. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Long term renters then maybe dragging that average down. All right, fascinating stuff, Brendan. It's all available on the website CSO.ie. But thanks for running through the figures with us and on a release this morning. We do appreciate it.
No problem. All the best.
All right. Brendan Murphy, statistician with the census section of the CSO. So some interesting headline figures there. An increase in holiday homes, 18% less, 18% more people have moved into derelict vacant properties. All right. Some interesting stuff. All right. 086 6020 5000. Do I have to take a break? I do have to take this break and then we'll be back with more. Okay, we're joined on the program now by Janice. Good morning to you, Janice. Thanks for taking the call.
Morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm okay. Right, you are hoping someone out there might have been in a similar position before and might be able to help. And this relates to a member of your family. What's the situation, Janice?
So the situation is my son, Joshua, applied for carers loans to care for my daughter, you know, to enable me to work.
Mm-hmm.
Which then is going to enable me, obviously, to pay for all her appointments, private appointments, etc. Now, this was back in November last year, so we're talking 9 months ago, and we're still fighting it. We're not getting anywhere. You know, we put in a review, we put in an appeal. We're not getting no answers whatsoever. We're just kind of at our wits' end. You know, he's 20 years of age. He's took on a big responsibility, you know, as does anybody that, you know, provides care. And I just feel like we're not getting anywhere. We don't know who to turn to. We're just wondering if anyone's been in the situation, what they've done. Are we at the stage we need to fund a solicitor, you know, to fight this for us?
We're going to make inquiries as well, of course, here. So, I mean, in them refusing the original application, did they give a reason? Is it they believe that he's not actually a full-time carer for his sister?
the social welfare inspector came out. I'll not mention her name, but
no,
she had
don't.
Come out.
Yeah.
And she had come to the door. She'd actually, you know, when she had left my house, I was actually in tears. She accused me, well, she accused Joshua that he wasn't living there. She didn't believe he was living there and he wasn't providing full-time care for Amelia. You know, which isn't the case. Joshua's never lived anywhere else. I don't think I'll ever get him out of home, you know, but... So I was down to her belief that he wasn't living there and he wasn't providing full-time care for her. We obviously argued the case. We put in a review, we put in an appeal, we put in even more evidence, you know, that he is providing care. We recently, there a few weeks back as well, the bloke in Sons of Ice here in Buncana helped us out with a letter showing that there is more care now because she's moved from Cassin and the orthotic bracing, you know, so there's more that needs to be done with that. We proved the fact that I'm contracted to 36 hours a week, yet for carers alone, you have to do a minimum of 35 hours a week. Mm-hmm. So my very minimum of work is 36 hours a week. Generally, I do a lot more than that. You know, I'm meant to be on my week off now, but I've ended up covering today, tomorrow. I'm covering Saturday, Sunday, and I have a mandatory training course on Monday. So there's an extra 5 days that it's like, right, Joshua, you have to have her now so I can work. Not have to have her. He's willing to have her.
No,
you know,
I mean,
he enjoys having her and has that bond with her.
It enables you to work. And as you say, you're saving the state to some extent because in working, you're able, it would cost much more for the care to be provided outside of the home if that were relevant. But also in terms of you're paying for expenses, appointments and all that kind of stuff, your son caring's allowing you to do that. You're funding that yourself. So it makes every sense for the state to recognise your son as his sister's carer.
It really does, Greg. You know, like I've at the stage, I've kind of contemplated quite a few times, you know, of handing him a notice to work because I feel like I'm putting his life on hold because he's getting nothing. Now, I'm lucky in the position that I'm in with the work that I have. You know, I'm able to kind of obviously provide for both of them, you know, and hand him out a bit of money, which I don't mind doing, but... You know, he's finding it tough because, as he says, you know, I work hard to earn those wages. It's not up to me to kind of keep him at 20 years of age.
But
you know,
he's also,
like, he can't even go out and grab a cup of coffee with his mates without borrowing money off me.
Of course, but he's also a full-time carer, and full-time carers get an allowance when they're recognised as being full-time carers. He's not looking for nothing that he's not entitled to. Yes, it's his sister. Yes, it's great that he can care for his sister, but he is also a full-time carer and should be recognised as such. I don't think that's, you know, there's no two sides to that. Have you had an appeal officially rejected, or was it just the first application that's been officially rejected and you've had no contact since?
The first application was refused, so we were advised then to put in for a review and appeal. We were told to do both of them at the same time. They acknowledged that they had received them, and that's it. You know, we've had counsellors, secretaries, you know, contacting them, asking them, you know, what's happening, and the only response that we're getting back is Joshua will be informed in writing when a decision is made. Now, we were told originally when it was refused and we put in the review and the appeal that it would take... between, I think it's 12 or 15 weeks. Don't quote me on that, I'm not sure. Yeah. But even if it is the 15 weeks, we're way beyond that and we've still had nothing. You know, and this is 9 months down the line now.
Yeah, yeah. And really this has all come from, if I'm not mistaken, one person's, who's nameless, one person's opinion. So if that person initially in the inspection and says, right, okay, we're good to go, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. It has come down to one person's opinion.
It has come down to that one person's opinion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're very, not that we're very focal on what's going on, but, you know, my daughter has a Facebook page. It's obvious Joshua's caring for her. You know, he takes her out and about, you know, play parks. Mm-hmm. Like she had actually said, if he was providing full-time care, he should be in the house 24/7.
Yeah.
I said, so he shouldn't be taking his sister out to play park. He shouldn't take her to the shop, you know, out to her grandparents. He says, no, she should be in the house 24. He should be in the house 24/7 if he's providing care. Mm. Now, that sounds barbaric to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, listen, you know, I know you've had politicians' offices on this. We're going to make inquiries ourselves. I am optimistic. Hopefully something might come of this. Janice, for you, for your son, what he's doing to be recognised as it should be, for also his well-being, that he has his own money to do his own things as well, but also that he can continue in the job he wants to do, but not job, but you know what I mean, in caring for his sister. So leave it with us. Let's hope there's a positive resolution to it.
perfect.
Thanks, great. Take care. Bye bye. All right, take care of yourself. 086 60 25,000. Now we're joined on the program by Phil Coulter. Phil, thank you so much for taking the call this morning. We really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure to talk on Highland Radio, Craig. Always a pleasure.
And I wish it were under different circumstances. It's in relation to the very sad passing at just 56 years of age of Sinead O'Connor, someone you worked with. You produced some of her work. She famously recorded one of your tracks as well. I mean, your background is second to none. So who better to sort of assess Sinead as an artist than yourself? Phil, how brilliant was she?
Without a doubt, on a purely musical level, she was one of the finest voices this country has ever produced. I mean, I'm fortunate that I've worked in the studio with some major, major global talent. But Sinead O'Connor was up there with the finest of them. And she was, without a shadow of a doubt, something very, very special. From a songwriter's point of view, her ability to breathe life into a lyric was exceptional. I mean, I consider myself very blessed that she recorded a couple of my most personal songs, Scorn Not His Simplicity and The Shores of the Swilly. And her ability just to inhabit a lyric and to bring it to life was uncanny. Because here's the great irony about Sinead. The image of Sinead that a lot of people have was of, you know, being very lippy, very mouthy, and like, you know, just defending her very passionately held beliefs, which she was very ready to do, and that attracted as much criticism as it did admiration, I have to say. But for me, those were distractions. You know, for me, people had forgotten why Sinead became famous in the first place, which was her voice. That's a God-given instrument, which she was second to none, and it was an otherworldly voice. And that's something which I think my firm belief is that Sinead was never happier than when she was actually singing. That was when she was at her best. That was when she was at peace. And my sad prayer now is that God love her, that she's finally found peace, because she did have a troubled life. She was a complex lady, Sinead.
Yeah, and as I said earlier in the show, Phil, it's that side of her that I felt her normality, she had to deal with what a lot of people had to deal with, and particularly last year in the passing of her son. It's just absolutely heartbreaking. Mm. But she leaves behind her such a legacy of amazing, amazing music by all accounts.
Entirely. I mean, she's one of the few global superstars that this country's ever produced. I mean, you just have to look at the outpouring of grief right across the world, internationally, right across Europe, right across the United States. She was, you know, like, she left an imprint, there's no doubt about that. I consider myself very fortunate to have worked with Sinead, to have written songs for her. I mean, I'll tell you about Sinead, about that fragility in Sinead, because even, Greg, in her finest hours, when everything was going swimmingly in her career, there was a vulnerability to Sinead. There was always a fragile side to Sinead, which I was aware of very early on. I'll tell you, this is a story of how I got the gig to produce Sinead. I was working with Van Morrison, producing an album called No Prima Donna, which was a tribute album where guests were invited to come on and sing a Van Morrison song. And Sinead was one of those chosen. On the particular evening that she was coming in to do her bit, in the control room, there was Van Morrison, there was Elvis Costello, there was Marianne Faithfull, there was Derek Bell from the Chieftains. So this was a gathering of pretty heavyweights, you know. I looked down to the studio and see Sinead come in, and she looked up at the control room and saw this gathering of heavyweights. And right there, myself, being a father of a lot of daughters, I could see, what I saw was not the lippy, mouthy Sinead O'Connor. What I saw was a very vulnerable, very shy young woman. This was back in 1994. So I did two things, Greg. First of all, I cleared the control room. Secondly, I went down to Sinead, and we'd only spoken on the phone. And I went up to her and I gave her a hug. And I said, Sinead, forget about all of those guys. You and I are here now. Just relax, and we're going to make this happen. And you're going to be fine. What does that tell you? It tells you that Sinead needed that. I found that she needed that. Someone to put an arm around her and say, you know what, Sinead, this is going to be fine. Because the very next day, Greg, because we got on so well, and because she had found in me somebody that was not only able to produce her records, but had a kind of a fatherly, protective kind of a streak, the following day she called me and she said, Phil, I can't get over how chilled out you are. Would you like to produce my new album? That's the truth. That's how our relationship started. And that was the relationship right through the album. There was never a cross word. She never threw the toys out of the pram. There was no histrionics, no drama. I found her to be a superb professional. And her voice in the studio, trust me, was something otherworldly.
Phil Coulter, thank you so much for your time, and what a beautiful tribute. Thank you indeed. Phil Coulter there, speaking about the passing of the late and great Sinead O'Connor. That's where we have to leave it on the programme today. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9. Stay tuned. Around the Northwest is coming up for you after the news at 12, which is read for you now by Donald Kavanagh. Have a great day, everyone.